You're listening to 97.3 LPFM WRIR, and this is Open Source RVA. On this special web edition of our show, we talk with Kimberly Gray and Kristen Larson, Richmond School Board representatives from the 2nd and 4th districts, respectively, discussing the near end of this another troubling budget season for the school district and some of the tough choices the board faced and still faces. I'm with Kim Gray and Kristen Larson, who represent the 2nd and 4th district school boards seats, respectively. Welcome, ladies.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Right, and we're talking budget. It's been a kind of a tough, would it be fair to say it's been kind of a tough budget season?
More than tough.
More than tough? I mean, it seems like every budget season is a tough budget season these days.
Well, I haven't seen one that we've had anything but cuts. So it's 5 years of significant cuts. So it gets more and more difficult as we go.
And I guess when you listen to some of the banter out there, there's a question of, well, wait, so RPS has the highest per student rate that we're paying, but then there's, on the converse of that, it's the highest percentage overall budget for any of the localities surrounding. How do we meet in the middle on that?
What do you mean the highest percentage?
In other words, when you look at the total budget, or excuse me, I'm sorry, it's the lowest,
percentage. Mm-hmm.
I said
right.
The highest.
Of the
lowest
local
percentage, yeah, of the various localities. I think, what are we at, 20% or something?
Yeah, we get the smallest percentage of the local city council budget.
As opposed to Hanover, for instance, is about almost 50% or 48.6% or something like that. I forget what Enrico is, but yes, you guys are lowest. But then again, highest per student cost. So, I mean, where do you meet in the middle on that?
Well, I think a lot of the issues, the number one issue that makes us more expensive to operate is that we have more facilities with less children in them. So it's not the most efficient way, and people really push and fight for neighborhood schools. But the reality is, if we want higher quality, we're going to have to be more efficient. So we have less students who live in the city that actually attend their public schools than the other localities. We have a high rate of students who go to private schools. So I think the kids that we do serve, we have a free and reduced lunch population that's above what all the surrounding counties and localities have. We have higher students with disabilities rate. And
so you have some of these additional expenses on you, but you're saying, too, that you have an efficiency issue in terms of your facilities.
We do.
Which brings us probably pretty quickly into one of the things that you guys are looking at doing that's become rather controversial, which is looking again at possibly closing a couple of schools. Two schools?
We have two on the budget, yeah.
But these are mystery schools at this point. Is there any talk at this point of how what process is going to be followed to look at which schools need to be closed?
At our last meeting on Monday, I brought up the need to expedite the process, because parents, especially in my district, some of the Fisher parents are really nervous that Fisher is going to be on the chopping block again.
And now Fisher was, during the most recent redistricting or realignment of the district look, or the lines for the school attendance boundaries, there we go.
Attendance zones,
Attendance zones. That was one of the schools, as well as, I guess, Cary, J.B. Cary,
mm-hmm.
right?
Cary, Bellevue, Fisher, mm-hmm. and there was one other school. There were four schools on the list.
Southampton was on it.
Southampton.
One point.
Yes.
Yeah.
So those four were sort of mentioned previously, and I guess Cary and Fisher had come up with some unique ways to try to save themselves
and boost their enrollment. And but the process of that rezoning was very flawed when you look at, no one looked at the facility condition, no one looked at the school performance, the parental involvement. So there are other factors at play that will help us determine what the most feasible schools to close and move into schools that are high performing.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, what we saw in the previous process in no way necessarily would give indication or hint of what might come in looking at the two schools that we might be looking at closing now. Is that what you're saying?
I think the board, that there's consensus that we look at this a little differently this time, and that the board wants to look at all the factors and not just the recommendations of the rezoning committee.
Now, are you likely to engage the public in this as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you can't close schools without involving the public. And, you know, I've already heard from a lot of Fisher parents and non-Fisher parents just saying, you know, that especially in regards to the open enrollment, which Fisher is a big open enrollment school. I think 60 or 70% of the school comes through open enrollment, and they don't draw from their zone because there aren't a lot of children in their zone. So Fisher needs to be looked at really closely to see what we can do to increase enrollment. It's a strong school, and I think that the way it was on the chopping block before, it didn't really take all those things into consideration.
For that one, it's really location, 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 right? I mean, it's sort of in the hinterland, so to speak, very close to Chesterfield.
It is, and it's in a neighborhood that just doesn't have a lot of school-aged children.
So it looks like it might be a good option.
So it's, if you're only taking into consideration the zone that it's in, then it's sort of set up for failure almost, because it doesn't have a strong base to begin with.
Failure in who you're going to choose.
Well, yes.
On the other hand,
if we look at it from a different point of view, like what can we do to increase the open enrollment? Can we tweak the zone lines to get more children zoned for Fisher? And these are some things I've been talking to the folks at Fisher about. You know, let's think outside of the box of how we can increase enrollment at the school.
And the reason you do that is right now Fisher is one of the schools that you would look at as a success in terms of academic achievement.
Mm-hmm. And parental involvement. And the other concern I have about Fisher is where it's located. It's located in a neighborhood. It's very residential. And if you've ever been there, you would know it would be extremely hard to repurpose the building. So we have other school buildings in, you know, more commercial areas where you could take that building and do, you know, turn it into apartments. Not that that's what I want to do, but the potential's there. Fisher, a lot of the neighbors, and I heard this when I was campaigning, are just worried that if the school closed, they'd have an empty school building in the neighborhood.
Blight.
Mm-hmm. So now, of course, the reason looking at closing these schools, the whole reason for it is that you do have a budget gap.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that you guys are moving forward with in terms of closing that gap? Kim?
Well, we look to the central office for a big part of what we think is disproportionate to other school districts. We have a high amount of our dollars, our general fund dollars, that are in central office. And I know a lot of people differ with us on that are in the education, on the education side, and the school administration pleaded with us, but we want to find some balance, because, you know,
and here you mean balance between cuts in the classrooms versus,
yeah, we want to protect the classroom at all cost. And every year that I've done a budget, we've increased class sizes and we've cut teacher jobs, and the central office has pretty much been insulated from it all. And
that was the proposal this time around as well.
Right. And even at, Kristen was at our town hall that followed her town hall. Glenn Sertovan and I did a town hall. We had a director of one of the departments that was up for outsourcing come in and say, I can find you $500,000 tomorrow if you don't outsource us. Well, if you can find it as an incentive not to be outsourced, then the money has always been there. I mean, it may be more difficult. You may be running on less, but it's...
Maybe he should have come forward with that $500,000 earlier.
Right. Before we look at cutting teachers, we need to look at cutting our non-instruction
side of the budget. And that is where this budget goes, right, as you are moving forward.
We directed it towards non-instruction, what we consider non-instruction.
Now, another, I guess, issue that you're looking at in looking for places to trim is one of the biggest outsourced items that you have right now, which is CCP. That's the Capital City Program, which is run by CIS, Communities and Schools, which is...
No.
Or not CIS.
Community Education
CEP,
Partners.
CEP, Community
actually
Education Partners, which is Tennessee-based.
Actually, it's not run by CEP any longer. They are now run by what I thought was SESE, but it's actually Success Schools.
Success Schools.
Out of Philadelphia.
And CEP, the company that was running it, has essentially divested itself in other states of these types of schools.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it looks maybe like CCP is the last of the schools that they maybe are operating this way, if they are operating. Again, you said that it's, what is it, Success in?
Success Schools.
Success Schools. So it's not SESE, which stood for?
SESE, I think, is a subsidiary, special education.
It's the umbrella group.
It's
for Success Schools is under this umbrella.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's a bit confusing because there are lots of hands.
But it's something of a subcontract at this point.
Yes.
Right.
So you guys are looking at trimming possibly that contract as well?
We did
not allocate funds to renew the contract for the next school year. Not only are we spending on that contract $4.8 million in our general fund dollars, there's Title I, and now there's school improvement money that would have been $1.5 million over the next 3 years allocated to that school. It's also called the Richmond Alternative Program. It's many names, but if you're looking on the Department of Ed website, you'd look under Richmond Alternative Program and you'd see the testing results, and it's in the school improvement mode, and it's,
in other words, it's not performing.
It's low, very low performing, which the expectations are low because we're dealing with students that have demonstrated an inability to control themselves.
Although that school does have special dispensation, so to speak, in terms of what kind of scores it has
right.
to get.
They're under accreditation accreditation, which is
they're not meeting their alternative accreditation.
They're not meeting the lower bar that's been set. So.
So again, this is, you're not funding it in the current budget. You're looking at getting, they will be phased out essentially at this point is the way it's.
Well, that's the plan. And also there were additional ADA funds, over $1 million that we were looking at spending in that building for a new elevator. And the building sits in the middle of Gilpin Court, which is in, by RRHA, it's in a mode to be torn down. And
it's a neat old building.
And the whole neighborhood is
to be torn down,
repurposed. So the school building was built in the 50s, and it requires a lot of ADA remediation. And we wanted to move quickly because we don't have the flexibility not to follow our ADA settlement. So if we're in the building, we'd have to invest over $1 million just to get it up to speed.
Now, of course, the contract was with CEP was to build them a new building
right.
many years ago, and it never has happened. So this is a new board coming in, new priorities, saying this is not something we can continue with. What is the alternative to the alternative, though? Clearly, you have to come up with some way of providing remedial education to kids that CEP has, or CCP, I guess, has shown in the past some significant success with helping these kids, right?
Well, part of the irony is that we had it in-house, and many of the people who are at CEP or SESE or Success Schools, whatever you want to call it now, are retired Richmond Public Schools employees. The administrator there is a retired principal. The former principal there is another retired principal from Richmond Public Schools, all the top tier administrators.
So you're saying we were doing it anyway all along?
Well, I think that if we talk about the talent and the ability, it's there, and maybe the process that we used in-house was a little bit different. But I think that we have the capability to do it for a lot less, because we're talking 210, 200.
Mm-hmm. And we're paying for 400 students, based on the contract.
Right. The per pupil cost, if you divide that out, was over $20,000 per student. So I think we could do it equally as well, if not better, for less money.
That's $20,000 per year per student.
It's about 23.
Yeah, and that's not including some of the
federal money.
And a Richmond student, just your average student is what? It's about 7
12
or 12?
12 or 13.
Well, we're
on average.
I'm thinking Hanover. Hanover is about 7.
Because we're close to 14,000 per student, which is why we're the highest in the region. It's 13 and some change.
It depends, I mean, that's not equal to every school because some of our schools are Title I and some aren't. But.
Has CCP factored into that average?
I don't think so.
In other words, if you took out that 23,000 or 24,000 per student, does that potentially...
I don't think so because it's a contract.
Well, I think that the per pupil or per...
It's an average.
The daily student average, our whole budget is factored into that. So, yeah, in that sense, it would increase the amount of per pupil cost overall.
So removing that as an additional expense could actually lower the per pupil cost overall.
And it would increase how the state calculates our instruction dollars. That contract wasn't included. So we have one of the lowest I think, what was the percentage per dollar? It was 56 cents or 55 cents per dollar towards instruction. And part of the justification that the administration came back was, oh, we contract out some of our instruction, but we can't count it because it's a contract. So,
this would bring some of that back.
Right.
Can you talk? I don't want to get too bogged down on Patrick Henry, which was another recent vote to go ahead and re-up the contract for that school, now increasing it to 5-year, which I presumably will help them to get financing on the building so that they can move ahead with repairs and construction. But what came out of the same meeting, I believe, was the idea that the administration put forward possibly of some sort of an alternative charter school for special needs students. Now, this is something that you guys had not heard about prior to that meeting. Is that right?
Yeah, it was introduced on Monday.
Now, what are your thoughts on that?
A couple of thoughts. Opening a charter school, even if the administration said this would start as 12 students with a maximum capacity of about 48, even with a population that small, opening it as a charter school is a lot of work. And so I asked the question during the meeting on Monday night, why is this charter?
And not a program.
And they responded and said, because of the curriculum and the funding.
They get state grants.
There's some grant money associated with it. And I think the goal, if I understood it correctly, is this is to open next fall. And that's pretty aggressive to write a charter, get it approved, have students apply and get in. There's a lot to work through. I'm concerned about the timeline. I also think, I don't think we have any or have had any charter schools like this in Virginia. I think they did one in D.C. recently for special needs. Just looking at how students apply and making sure that it's done in the right way, that legally everything is on the up and up.
Could that present problems?
I just think we need to make sure that we're doing it because this would fall under the category of an at-risk population, and you can create charter schools for an at-risk population.
But it has to be open. The enrollment process
it still has to be open to any student to apply.
Well, I don't think
you can discriminate by
the
disability, what the at-risk category is, if it's permissible. But if my child fell into that category and there were only 12 slots, I'd be competing against other families for one of those slots. And the way that process is developed, it has to be a fair process, and it has to be open across the city to all
of the kids who would
all the kids
fall
who
into
would
this
be,
category.
Right.
So, if you were doing a dyslexic school, special
exactly.
school for dyslexic children,
children with dyslexia,
that say it backwards. I don't think that, of course, the state even recognizes that. Or
it doesn't.
But if they were to do something like that, which would be a boon, since that's one of the most common special needs, I guess, for students. Right.
Well, this is going to include children with autism, but their definition is the more extreme end of the spectrum. So perhaps my child doesn't meet the severity in their point of view, okay. But I think my child would be a good candidate to be in that program, but they're saying.
So they would exclude your child, perhaps that, because they're
somewhere
on the spectrum.
This is what we need to work out.
We don't know.
And this is where I think we need to look to other places that have done this already, because I like the idea of the program. I'm a little concerned about it being a charter
and being fast tracked.
Like okay.
Yeah,
my concerns are more around the lack of transparency, and blindsiding your board is never a good thing. And
that's been something that's happened a couple of times here recently.
It's
right?
happened quite a bit. I think the new board is less likely to bite on to these ideas when they're not included in the planning and development process. But
so what are some other recent examples of things where the board has been sort of blindsided by?
Well, I think the K-6 at Cary and Fisher, it went from, you know, a theory and an idea
and
their strategic plan.
K-6 moving from a K-5
to a K-6. I think that it was presented, and it was presented as a wish on their wish list for Cary. Fisher never had that in their plan, but it was sort of thrown together, and a motion came forward at the very last meeting, December 3rd, of the last board. It wasn't publicly noticed. It wasn't anything on an agenda. We still haven't gotten a full budget and a plan for what this is going to cost. So, yes, it was presented in the past as part of John B. Cary's idea, you know, pie-in-the-sky strategic plan that they want to be a K-8 school to increase their enrollment. However, the actual motion to move forward on it was never put on the agenda.
Another one was the turnaround contracts, right? The contracts for these companies to come
in. Oh, yeah.
In
and, mm-hmm. and that came after they were supposed to be approved. Mm-hmm. So
in other words, they had already hired them, basically. They were in operation.
They were already working in our schools.
And then they brought you something to approve
right.
these contracts, and you were right. not even aware that there were people in the schools doing these jobs.
Right.
And the
deadline for CCP.
The deadline had passed.
Oh, the deadline had passed.
For the turnaround specialist.
That was the part that really bothered me, because we had been presented with the information twice, and when I found out the deadline was when I read it in the paper that talked about one of our meetings where we brought up the issue.
And then we had to have an emergency meeting to approve the memorandum of agreement, and they brought in the state DOE, and part of what concerned me with their presentation was that their whole turnaround model, they said, is modeled after Richmond because of our past successes. And they talked about, Dr. Kathleen Smith talked about how the charting the course, which is a way to pace the curriculum, is what they use across the state. And I don't know if it's a sustainable model. I have concerns about the entire process, because we did see over that 12-year period a peak in the SOL scores, and now
we're
on the decline. So if the whole state is dependent upon the Richmond model.
Now has there been any effort by the board, I guess, the Richmond board, to look at remediating, I guess, its relationship with the administration? Bearing in mind these,
what do you mean?
These we'll call them lapses in communication, mm-hmm. To repair those. I don't know if there were any relationships to repair necessarily, but I guess to try and further and improve communication prior to these sorts of blindsides, I guess, or these things that you were unaware of that sort of come up.
I think it's interesting because, I mean, we are 7 new out of 9 people. And we're coming in, and we, first of all, we have to get up to speed on a lot of what's going on, and we are taking a very different approach than the last board. Well, than most of the last board, not included. But I think it is a little shocking for them, and I think they are trying to adjust, and I mean, time will tell. That's kind of where I am. I think the special ed charter school thing, I think when they brought it to us the other night, they thought they were trying to bring it to us early. I'm still concerned because the timeline looks really aggressive to me. So, you know, again, time will tell. We'll see what happens.
My other concern is these types of policy shifts are board decisions. So if we decide that we want a Richmond-generated charter, the board should be deciding that, not the school administration. It's sort of the tail wagging the dog when the administration brings these innovations forward. Not to say that it shouldn't be a communication going back and forth, but your board shouldn't be the last to find out. And with respect to the Charter Review Commission and the Charter Task Force that they have for this, the administration is handpicking all the people that are on those committees.
Is the board approving those picks?
No, we have not. And I questioned that on the last board, but I got shot down numerous times. But, you know, the community member for the Patrick Henry Charter Review Board just happened to be a recent retiree from Richmond Public Schools. And yes, you know, he may have a connection to one or two students in Richmond Public Schools, familial relations, but that doesn't mean he's a unbiased community member, because if you've worked for
the school district
for multiple years, you have relationships there and bonds there that may or may not let you see things in the most objective way. So I think that board representation on these commissions, people that we appoint on these committees or task force, is critical to the process, because we want to be able to get sound, solid information that's unbiased.
So moving forward with the budget, we've moved quite a ways through that process at this point. What's left? What's left to do, I guess?
I think what's left to do for the next 4 years?
Wouldn't it be nice if that were the case? No.
I think we looked at quantitative cuts. We made it cheaper. Now we have to make it better. And I think that we need to prioritize. We haven't really had an opportunity. Kristen's been calling and calling for us to have a retreat moment for the board to come together. Kristen has asked since day one for a time for
us.
Why
you guys met at the pub after?
You know what? That was the starting point. We met back in January. Was that January?
You're talking about the recent after the budget. That was Jeff Bourne's infinite wisdom and calling for a drink after a meeting.
Like
and
a cooling just off to period kind of, after something. That
just,
was a,
just a debriefing, because we went through a crisis situation. But
you passed what you needed to pass.
Right. And we may seem like we differ, the nine of us, but for most of the bulk of what we want to do, we find common ground. So it's important for us to prioritize that common ground. For instance, IB and other areas, because we want to be able to go to the mayor and city council and ask for additional funds to fund things we know are working.
All right. Well, thank you guys again for being here. This is Kim Gray, who represents the 2nd District, Richmond Public Schools, and Kristen Larson, who represents the 4th District. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to this special Web Extra edition of Open Source RVA. I'm Chris Dovey. My co-hosts, as always, are Don Harrison and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi. And hey, up yours. Up your donation to WRIR. This week is Pledge Week, but you can donate to the station anytime. $50 gets you a cool WRIR t-shirt, and any donation gets you a great special Open Source RVA sticker. Donate and tell them Open Source sent you.